The headlines. Jordan strongly condemns what it calls the racist attacks by Israel on Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem outlets. Calls are growing for the release of the body cam video of the recent fatal police shooting of a black man in the U.S. state of North Carolina. And fresh restrictions come into force in Germany to stem the spread of the coronavirus following the passage of a controversial bill in Parliament. Hello, welcome. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Jordan has strongly condemned what it calls the racist attacks by Israel on Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem and Mount Lutz. Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi called for prompt international action to protect Palestinians. Safadi warned of dangerous consequences if Israel fails to stop the attacks. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement praised Palestinians for confronting the regime forces who were attacking Muslim worshippers. The Palestinian resistance group Hamas vowed to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Quds, and its people. Israeli forces violently clashed with people protesting restrictions on their gatherings in the old city of Al-Quds during the fasting month of Ramadan. They fired water cannons as well as live ammunition to disperse protesters. Over 100 demonstrators were injured during the clashes. We were earlier joined by our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil for more details on the situation in Jerusalem and Al-Quds.
What happened last night is that Palestinians in several areas of the occupied West Bank took to the streets in a number of protests and demonstrations. Protesters chanted against Israel and in support of Jerusalem. Al-Quds also demanding that the Israeli police attacks against Palestinians in the Holy City of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, should stop. They were also demanding freedom of movement to reach Al-Aqsa Mosque and to pray in the Holy Month of Ramadan. Several hours later, the clashes continued and spread to other areas in Bethlehem, in Qalqilya, in Azzoun.
Israel keeps up its destabilizing actions throughout the region. The regime has once again escalated tensions with Iran. Israel's dangerous gambits against regional countries seem to be undermining its own security.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it routinely launches airstrikes against targets in Syria. It is also widely blamed for high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran. The regime is believed to have carried out the recent sabotage attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, which operates under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran was quick to pledge to retaliate for the attack on Natanz. Tel Aviv apparently knows no limit when it comes to clandestine operations against other countries. The regime always says it carries out such actions out of worries for its own security. Such dangerous policies could be starting to backfire. This week, a sensitive missile factory in central Israel was rocked by a powerful blast. The huge explosion, which created a mushroom cloud, hit the Tomer factory for advanced weapons. Israeli officials say the blast was a test. On Thursday, a missile fired from Syria landed near the secretive Dimona nuclear weapons facility, triggering warning sirens. The Israeli military said the projectile was a surface-to-air missile fired by Syrian forces against Israeli warplanes. It says the projectile overflew its target and landed near Dimona. But the heavily protected nuclear facility is some 300 kilometers south of Damascus. It is a very long distance for an errant missile.
Israel has escalated tensions with Iran and does not seem to be trying to make a secret of its operations against the regional power. Israeli sources keep leaking the covert operations. But will the regime always be able to hit and run? Tehran has said that it will respond at the right place and at the right time.
The missile fired from Syria on Thursday landed just some 30 kilometers away from the notorious Israeli nuclear facility. Military experts say this has once again revealed that much trumpeted Israeli air defenses are penetrable. The projectile made it through the air defense layers despite the fact that anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems around Dimona have been significantly boosted in anticipation of a possible retaliatory missile or drone attack by Iran or resistance groups close to Iran.
By looking at this particular site, Dimona, where this weapon nearly hit, it's saying, well, if you really want to have some sort of fight, you do realise that your nuclear facilities, we know exactly where they are, and they could be hit too. And I'm afraid just simply repeating the lies about the impenetrability of the Israeli air defences and missile defences is not going to save anybody in a conflict. It's really just hot air.
Israeli media, like the Times of Israel, have highlighted the fact that the missile landed deep inside Israel amid heightened tensions with Iran and after Tehran's pledge of retaliation. Some other media organizations, like the Middle East Monitor, said Netanyahu's comments after the attack on Natanz looked like a claim of responsibility, and this may have pushed Iran to retaliate. Israel seems increasingly worried about the possibility of the United States removing sanctions against Iran to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal that America abandoned under former President Donald Trump. Israel has always been a vociferous critic of the deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for possible repercussions for the region and beyond.
Officials and protesters in the U.S. state of North Carolina are demanding the police department make public the body camera footage of an encounter that resulted in the death of a black man. State and local officials say the footage needs to be released before public anger over the incident grows further. On Wednesday, 42-year-old Andrew Brown Jr. was fatally shot by a sheriff's deputy in Elizabeth City. The sheriff's office has declined to share much information about the incident. It says the shooting happened after Brown fled from the police while they were going to serve him an arrest warrant for drug-related charges. The incident occurred amid ongoing protests across the U.S. over the killing of African Americans at the hands of law enforcement officers. With a conviction in the George Floyd case, accountability for murderous cops in the U.S. appears to have taken a longer way to step forward. However, police brutality remains prevalent and could spark a second consecutive summer full of protest. Rami Mazzari has more from Chicago.
Much of America breathed a sigh of relief when the cop who killed George Floyd was convicted of murder. A not guilty verdict was widely expected to have set off deadly rebellions on the scale of 1968 when Martin Luther King was assassinated, or 1992 when cops were acquitted in the Rodney King beating case. But across the country, there's a feeling that the calm won't last, because cops in America kill an average of 3 people per day. With police now often forced to wear body cameras and cell phones serving as citizen cameras, there seems to be a constant stream of shocking cop killings on the nightly news. North Carolina, Oklahoma, here in Chicago, and in too many other places to count, have all seen major protests against police violence in the past weeks. Storefronts are being boarded up, and many wonder if they will stay that way all summer.
I mean, if someone knocked out on election night and they woke up today and you told them everything that was happening, if they didn't really pay that much attention to politics, aside from like the media telling them that Trump is bad, they would say, oh, Trump's still in power. I feel like the cops throughout the country, even in Chicago, have become even more emboldened than last year.
The George Floyd protests in 2020 were highly politicized by the Democratic Party. But many wonder if the party will encourage the same confrontational stances in 2021. President Joe Biden reportedly discussed deploying the National Guard to all 50 states ahead of the Floyd verdict, while some Republican-led states are introducing often shocking anti-protest legislation.
The protest that we saw in 2020 was more of a prelude than anything, because now that all these facts are out there, now that, like, you know, there's a huge light shining on police violence and how this is connected to the state and how the state continually arms the police no matter what they do, even if they've just murdered a 13-year-old kid, what is the state going to propose? More money to go to cops to train them, and that training goes to nothing.
The United States has become so divided that the threat of socioeconomic violence now occurs on a regular basis. Underpinning it all appears to be the widespread perception of a lack of justice caused by a fundamental corruption which appears almost impossible to remedy. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Germany has introduced tougher nationwide COVID-19 measures after Parliament passed a disputed law giving the federal government powers to impose virus-related curbs. The measures limit private gatherings, sports and shop openings in all areas with incidence rates of more than 100 new infections for 100,000 people. These regions will also witness overnight curfews. Regions with higher infection rates, schools will also turn into virtual mode. Restrictions followed the enactment of a new national law dubbed the Emergency Break amid disagreement with protest. The law allows authorities to impose lockdowns on states, ending state-by-state measures. Germany has reached its highest number of new infections since January, with over 2,000 daily cases. Germany's total cases have surpassed 3.2 million, while its death toll is at over 81,000. India's daily COVID-19 death toll has set a new record as the virus is spreading like wildfire in major cities. More than 2,600 people have died over the past 24 hours. The figure has taken the official toll to nearly 190,000 since the start of the pandemic. Over 340,000 new cases have also been reported, pushing the tally to around 16.5 million, second only to the U.S. Meanwhile, in the state of Western Australia, a three-day lockdown has come into force, affecting some 2 million people. Japan has already declared a state of emergency in Tokyo and three other prefectures just 3 months before the Olympic Games. The government announced restrictions in those regions amid a surge in cases involving new variants. Munawar Zaman says a dire shortage of oxygen supplies in India has made the COVID-19 situation extremely critical.
The situation continues to be critical, especially in the hospitals. Due to lack of oxygen supplies, there's a shortage of oxygen in the hospitals. And this is amid the central government is trying to do its best to send the oxygen supplies to different states. But look, the situation is extremely critical. And you have a population which is mammoth. I mean, it's not a country where 100, 200 million people are living. It's a country of 1.4 billion people. And to cater to these people is a humongous task. And the biggest shortcoming this time is the lack of beds in the hospitals and the shortage of oxygen supplies. There are on TVs, I can see the TV channels, the national media channels are running the stories on coronavirus 24/7. And it's really heartbreaking that people are losing their lives on the streets. They're losing life on the auto rickshaws because they don't get space in the hospitals because hospitals are turning them away.
Pakistan has announced strict measures in an attempt to stem the spread of the coronavirus. Authorities say that the country may soon be facing a situation similar to that of India if the current surge in COVID-19 cases continues. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
Pakistan has called out army to help police and other paramilitary personnel to enforce strict precautionary measures in bazaars and streets to contain what the government says a sudden surge in COVID-19 cases.
Agar humne ab ehtiyat na ki.
Prime Minister Imran Khan in a televised address warned the nation that his country may soon be facing a grim situation similar to that of India, where on an average 2,000 people die every day and more than 300,000 test positive.
I have appealed to the people time and again to follow precautionary measures. However, neither people are scared of coronavirus nor they are adopting any precautionary measures. And that is why now there is surge in coronavirus cases.
Under a new decision, Pakistan has shut down schools in regions with a surge in COVID-19 cases. All markets would be closed by 6 p.m. Indoor and outdoor dining have also been banned. Only 50% staff would be allowed to work in private and government offices, while offices would be closed at 2 p.m. On an average, 100 to 150 people die daily, while between 5,000 to 6,000 people test positive every day in 220 million populated country. So far, there are as many as 102,000 total active cases in Pakistan, while nearly 16,000 and 900 people have died since March last year. The government has warned the people to get ready to face complete lockdown of major urban centers if they do not put a mask on their faces to contain the virus.
People would die with hunger if government shuts down the cities. There would be shortage of food items like sugar, flour and oil. What would we do then?
A survey conducted by Gallup Pakistan last month reported that 65% people believe that the government is exaggerating the threat of the COVID-19. A significant number of people suffer from allergic linked diseases such as flu, cough, fever and asthma, and many of them die every spring weather in parts of Pakistan. However, since March last year, the medical nomenclature in Pakistan have changed, and now most of these diseases have been officially classified as COVID-19 cases under what is medically known as PCR testing system, which many medical experts believe are churning out false positive cases. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Indonesia has recovered debris from a submarine that went missing with 53 crew off the coast of Bali. According to the Indonesian Navy, the debris includes components and items from inside the stricken vessel. It said the items were found in the last location where the submarine was diving. The Navy added the recovered components would not have come outside the submarine if there had been no external pressure or without damage to its torpedo launcher. The submarine with 53 people on board lost contact during a drill in the Bali Sea last Wednesday. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. People from all walks of life regularly protest police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV. In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered, right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man.
At Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles. The protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem. It's a New Jersey problem. It's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, black lives matter. you know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance. But I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida. Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? One reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations. It appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us it appears as excessive, but for the officer at the given moment on the street it wasn't excessive, and the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage of the convenience store is not very, you know, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African-American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African-American women have been playing a central role.
If Eric was selling cigarettes,
let's arrest him. Let's have him go before a jury of his peers, and let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands. They kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah, absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said that to stop breathing. So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop, like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow, I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on the shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility. But again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
You know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even
within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
There's police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on a brand new episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen that we've been blessed with this opportunity to spend a few minutes of our day on reflecting and thinking about matters that, you know, sometimes we honestly don't have the time to consider because life happens and the world has been so chaotic lately. And the other day I was watching my niece color some unicorns because she's absolutely obsessed with them. And as she was coloring the unicorns, it reminded me of a short anecdote, a short little parable story that I think you guys will probably find interesting as well. So let's listen to our story. And we're going to be right back, so please stay with us.
The title of today's story is Parable of the Pencil. The pencil maker took the pencil aside just before putting him into the box. "There are five things you need to know," he told the pencil. "Before I send you out in the world, always remember them and never forget, and you will become the best pencil you can be. 1. You will be able to do many great things, but only if you allow yourself to be held in someone's hand. 2. You will experience a painful sharpening from time to time, but you'll need it to become a better pencil. 3. You will be able to correct any mistakes. 4. The most important part of you will always be what's inside. And 5. On every surface you are used on, you must leave your mark. No matter what the condition, you must continue to write." The pencil understood and promised to remember and went into the box with purpose in its heart. Now, replacing the place of the pencil with you, always remember them and never forget, and you will become the best person you can be. Again, the conditions. 1. You will be able to do many great things, but only if you allow yourself to be held in God's hand and allow other human beings to access you for the many gifts you possess. 2. You will experience a painful sharpening from time to time by going through various problems in life, but you'll need it to become a stronger person. 3. You will be able to correct any mistakes you might make. 4. The most important part of you will always be what's on the inside. And 5. On every surface you walk through, you must leave your mark no matter what the condition. You must continue to do your duties.
Thank you. the lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at this story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Now, I don't know who wrote this story, but I found it really interesting and to a certain degree quite on point. And if we really take every point that was made into the story and try to actively apply it into our lives, interestingly enough, we will find that things will fall into place better and easier and will flow smoothly. Life is always going to be complicated at the end of the day. There's going to be some rascal of a child that pours all the coloring pencils out of its box and breaks it and scatters it all over the house and draws on things that they shouldn't be drawing and this and that. If we apply that into our lives, well, life sometimes gets complicated. Sometimes people come into our lives that influence us and impact us in a very negative manner. Sometimes the circumstances of life lead us to do things that we weren't necessarily comfortable with, or we didn't even think that it was within our capacity to do. But all of this, at the end of the day, are tests and trials, and they're ways for us to actually figure out and learn what we're really made of. What kind of potentials do we have, and when the going gets tough, how tough can we possibly be? I especially enjoyed the first point that the story made, where it said, always remember that you're going to be in someone's hands. That might sound kind of scary and unpleasant, especially those who are obsessed with individualism and invest too much onto their personal ego and identity and forget that we are from the Lord and to the Lord do we return. No matter what we have in this life, even if there is no such thing as the hereafter, one day we will all die. The most atheist or agnostic or mystic or nihilistic or any person with any sort of ideology and doctrine still agrees on the fact that we're all going to die at the end. And once we do, after a while, it would be as if we never existed, in all honesty. And all that's left of us is how we were able to positively affect this world and the people around us. So even if we don't believe that we're in the hands of a divine, almighty, all-knowing, all-merciful power, we're still in the hands of time. We're still in the hands of our biological clocks that sort of a sand watch or a sand clock that the grains of sand slowly but surely flow through, and at some point they're still going to finish, right? So we're still at the hands of something. We're not entirely free as we think ourselves to be. So how wonderful would it be if we left ourselves in the hand of an entity which is just, which is kind, which is beneficent, which is forgiving, which knows what's best for us, and has facilitated and accommodated all of our needs and requirements, and who only cares about our wellness, our betterment, our felicity and success in this world, and especially in the hereafter. Especially in the hereafter, because that's our true abode. That's where we're meant to last forever. That's the place that once we have a transition to, we get to stay there and enjoy all the bounties till the end of no time. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. I'm so happy that you guys were with us. Inshallah, I hope you've enjoyed it and benefited from it like I have. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.